Today is Friday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. A top U.S. diplomat says diplomacy on Ukraine can still work.
President Zelensky is right. No one should panic, and no one is. We're looking at the facts.
U.S. President Biden might nominate a moderate for the Supreme Court.
But the Democratic coalition does not want a moderate judge. They want somebody who's very strongly committed on certain issues.
And rights groups urge athletes to speak up at the Beijing Olympics. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S. and its NATO allies remain committed to supporting Ukrainian sovereignty should Russia invade Ukraine. Biden made the remark in a call Thursday with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden also told Zelensky that the U.S. embassy in Kyiv remains open and fully operational after the State Department issued an order for eligible family members of staffers at the embassy to leave. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the U.S. has failed to address Moscow's main security concerns over Ukraine in the written document delivered on Wednesday, but he left the door open for more talks to ease simmering tensions. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Russia had a muted reaction to the U.S. written response to its stated security concerns about Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said this.
As for the content of the document,
there is a response that gives hope for the start of a serious conversation on secondary questions. But in this document, there was no positive response to the main question.
Реакции позитивной нет.
President Joe Biden had a phone conversation Thursday with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky thanked Biden for ongoing military assistance, with Russia massing more than 100,000 troops and heavy military equipment along its border with Ukraine. In an interview with Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty, Secretary of State Antony Blinken was asked whether the U.S. and Kyiv agree about how imminent the threat of a major Russian invasion might be.
President Zelensky is right. No one should panic, and no one is. We're looking at the facts. We are acting in a very deliberate way, and we're doing everything we can to make clear to Moscow that it has two paths before it, the path of diplomacy and dialogue to resolve differences peacefully, or the path of aggression, if that's what it chooses, and the massive consequences that will flow from that.
Russia says it is not planning to invade Ukraine and blames the U.S. for escalating tensions. The U.S. says it is coordinating every step with Ukraine and its NATO allies, preparing painful economic sanctions if Moscow invades, including stopping the controversial Nord Stream 2 oil pipeline, which runs from Russia to Germany. Victoria Nuland is the U.S. Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs.
With regard to Nord Stream 2, we continue to have very strong and clear conversations with our German allies, and I want to be clear with you today. If Russia invades Ukraine, one way or another, Nord Stream 2 will not move forward.
Earlier, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said her country will join in on tough sanctions if Russia invades Ukraine.
In case of further aggression, the full range of our responses is available, including Nord Stream 2.
With the world watching the Russia-Ukraine border and waiting, the U.S. says the next move is Russian President Vladimir Putin's. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
After the U.S. called for an open meeting early next week of the U.N. Security Council to discuss Russia's military buildup along three sides of Ukraine, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, put out a statement saying members of the Security Council must squarely examine the facts and consider what is at stake for Ukraine, for Russia, for Europe, and for the core obligations and principles of the international order should Russia further invade Ukraine. She went on to say, this is not a moment to wait and see. The council's full attention is needed now. China is watching with interest as Russia and the West face off over Ukraine. Beijing is engaged in its own territorial disputes and has offered political support for Moscow. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, China has also invested billions of dollars in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, which could be at risk in the event of any conflict.
Western nations have threatened unprecedented economic sanctions against Moscow if it invades Ukraine. If cut off by the West, could Russia look east to China for help? Professor Steve Tsang is the director of the China Institute at the University of London.
The policy I think China is likely to take is to do whatever they can to help the Russians to face up to the economic sanctions that the US and Europeans may impose on Russia. Economic links between China and Russia are not really strong enough to replace any break off of economic links between Russia and Europe.
Dmitry Sizlov is from the National Research University of Russia.
This foreign policy coordination will definitely increase because from the Russian perspective, intensification of the military partnership between Russia and China is precisely one of the major pains which Russia can inflict to the United States and NATO.
China has offered political support for Moscow in its standoff over Ukraine. Security analyst Julie Norman of University College London.
Even though there's these troop deployments to Eastern European states, no states are talking about directly sending troops into Ukraine itself to defend. And of course, China's taking note of that with some of their own territorial disputes in their own area.
Taiwan is China's biggest territorial dispute, and there is a risk of miscalculation as Beijing watches events unfold in Ukraine, says Steve Tsang.
The Chinese seeing the Americans and the Europeans talking big, but not doing very much about it, which would embolden them, overreach Taiwan and potentially miscalculate what the American responses to a crisis over Taiwan might be.
Despite their mutual rivalry with the US, China and Russia's interests don't always align. Beijing's multi-trillion dollar Belt and Road Initiative cut through several former Soviet bloc states, including Ukraine. A direct rail and ferry freight link opened in 2016, linking China with Ukraine's Black Sea coast via Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan, bypassing Russia. China has also funded infrastructure projects, including a new metro line for Kiev. If Russia invades Ukraine, could Beijing's investments in the region be at risk? Again, Steve Tsang of the University of London.
The more immediate impact on the Belt and Road Initiative would in fact be the Russian military intervention in Kazakhstan. And the Chinese government actually have shown that they are quite relaxed and comfortable with that. To them, it's more important to support authoritarian states and autocrats to stay in power and then for some of them to be closer to Russia than to China at the moment. Over the longer term, things may change.
In the short term, analysts say China is keen to keep a lid on the simmering tensions for at least the next few weeks as it prepares to host the Winter Olympics. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In an exclusive interview with VOA, Dr. Anthony Fauci, U.S. President Biden's chief medical advisor, explains what Biden means when he says the country is much better off now than it was a year ago regarding the pandemic. At the same time, Dr. Fauci admits COVID variants are causing far too many deaths.
We are quite clearly, and we have to admit it, being challenged by various surges of different variants. We just recently got through the Delta surge, and now we're faced with an Omicron surge. In the United States, the numbers are really concerning. We're averaging over 2,000 deaths per day. We have about 156,000 people in the hospital, and the cases are averaging between 600,000 and 700,000 a day. That's the tough news, the bad news. The somewhat encouraging news is that in many regions of the country, the outbreak has peaked and is turning around. We're seeing that explicitly and specifically in the northeastern part of the country, as exemplified by New York City, and in the upper Midwest in Chicago, also as far south as Washington, D.C. However, there are some states, southern states and western states, which are still surging, and some of them are starting to level off. I think the net effect is that you're going to see a peak and then an ultimate diminution of number of cases, and ultimately, as a late indicator, numbers of hospitalization. But we can't be overconfident that because this looks like it's turning around, that we're out of the woods. One of the things that we've got to continue to try and do is to get people vaccinated, because the data are extraordinarily clear. When you look at the number of hospitalizations and the severity of disease and compare unvaccinated people with vaccinated people, the difference is striking. I mean, very, very profoundly evident, the difference between vaccinated and unvaccinated. So it's a mixed bag. We do well if we're vaccinated and boosted, but we only have about 63% of the population is fully vaccinated, which means that 37% are not. So when the president says we're much better off, he's really referring to the fact that what we have now, we didn't have a year ago. We didn't have the vaccine implementation plan we have. We didn't have antivirals that were effective, and we have at least five now. We didn't have a lot of masks available. We now have hundreds of millions of masks, and we are now implementing about a half a billion rapid tests in the next month or so, followed by yet again another half a billion tests. So if you look at across the terrain of what's available for the American public in the form of vaccines, boosters, masks, tests, antiviral therapy, we're much, much better off than we were a year ago.
To talk about vaccine donations and why, in summary, it's so important in your view as a health professional that we're donating so many vaccines to other countries.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. You address a global outbreak by a global solution and a global effort. And that's why the United States has been committed to and will deliver on vaccine doses to low and middle income countries. So let's look at what's been done thus far. Over 400 million doses of vaccine have been given to over 115 countries. The United States has given or pledged 1.1 billion doses to be delivered between now and the middle of this year as we get into the fall. We've given or pledged $4 billion for COVAX, and we are now working with the companies to expand the capability of the companies such as Moderna and Pfizer and others to be able to ramp up their production to make doses available more quickly to the low and middle income countries. So the United States is leading the world in that by far.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief medical advisor to President Biden and the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He was speaking with my colleague, White House correspondent Anita Powell. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer announced his retirement Thursday, providing President Joe Biden an opportunity to fill his seat. Biden pledged to keep his campaign promise and nominate an African-American woman to replace Breyer. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittig-Husqvarna has this report.
In his retirement speech at the White House Thursday, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer said American democracy remains an experiment.
It's that next generation and the one after that, my grandchildren and their children. They'll determine whether the experiment still works. And of course, I am an optimist, and I'm pretty sure it will.
Breyer's retirement provides an opportunity for President Joe Biden to appoint his replacement, one of the most consequential actions for an American president. The Supreme Court is a key branch of the U.S. government that has the final say on the constitutionality of the actions of the administration, Congress, and the states. Biden said he will announce his nominee by the end of February.
The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court.
The 9 Supreme Court justices are appointed for life. Breyer is one of only 3 liberal justices appointed by Democratic presidents. The rest were appointed by Republicans, including 3 during the 4 years of Donald Trump's administration. In his 8 years in office, Barack Obama appointed 2 justices, with Republicans blocking his 3rd pick. With only 50 Democratic senators in the 100-seat U.S. Senate, Biden will need all their votes for his nominee to be confirmed. Biden would get at most 1 or 2 Republican votes if he picks a moderate judge, said Adam White, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
But the Democratic coalition does not want a moderate judge. They want somebody who's very strongly committed on certain issues, including criminal justice and other things. Further complicating this is the fact that President Biden pre-committed on the campaign trail to appointing the first black woman to the Supreme Court. So his pool of potential nominees is limited by that as well.
Biden aims to replace Breyer before midterm congressional elections in November. If Republicans retake control of the Senate, Biden will have a much harder time getting judicial and other nominees confirmed in the final 2 years of his term. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Human rights activists issued a call to action against the Beijing Olympics on Friday, urging athletes and sponsors to speak out against what they call the genocide games. At an online news conference organized by the group Human Rights Watch, activists representing Chinese dissidents and the minority Uyghur and Tibetan populations implored international participants to voice their opposition to the games being hosted by China. The Beijing Games begin next week. Iraq's military says 6 rockets hit Baghdad's international airport on Friday, damaging 2 commercial planes. No injuries were reported. The rockets struck in the early morning hours and fell on planes parked in a waiting area of Iraqi Airways, the country's biggest carrier. North Korea tested an upgraded long-range cruise missile and a tactical guided missile this week as leader Kim Jong-un visited a munitions factory producing a major weapons system, according to state media KCNA on Friday. Reuters correspondent Gloria So reports.
North Korea confirmed its latest missile launches on Friday as leader Kim Jong-un toured a factory producing a, quote, major weapons system. That's according to state media agency KCNA, who said a long-range cruise missile system update and tactical guided missile warhead were tested earlier this week. They marked 6 weapons tests so far this month, a flurry of activity that appears to be one of the busiest months ever for North Korea's missile program. The launches displayed a wide variety of weapons types and increasing sophistication. Kim did not attend this week's tests, according to a separate dispatch, but applauded the major weapons progress in his visit to the munitions factory. The launches triggered international condemnation and renewed calls for sanctions from the United States. Last week, North Korea said it would boost its defenses against the U.S. and hinted at lifting a self-declared ban on testing nuclear bombs and intercontinental ballistic missiles. None of those missiles or nuclear weapons have been tested in North Korea since 2017. But it kicked off a string of short-range ballistic missile launches as denuclearization talks with Washington stalled following a failed summit in Vietnam in 2019. Pyongyang has defended its missile launches as self-defense and accused the U.S. and South Korea of double standards.
That was Gloria So with Reuters. The world's biggest and most powerful space telescope found a parking space, plus a lottery winner who couldn't claim his prize, and a volcanic eruption may offer clues on the formation of planets. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us This Week in Space.
NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, reached its final destination this week, more than 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. The journey took about a month and now begins the fine-tuning for its mission to observe the history of our universe and seek signs of life outside our solar system.
It's orbiting just outside the orbit of the moon. It's about 4 times further away than the moon. So it always has to be pointed out towards deep space. It can't ever look back towards the Earth.
NASA's Amber Strawn told Vox that Webb can't look at Earth because it's an infrared telescope and the Earth is warm and would just glow in that spectrum of light. Webb fired its rocket thrusters for nearly 5 minutes to park itself in the sun's orbit where NASA intended. It will take months to align the $10 billion observatory's mirrors to begin its research missions in June. Meanwhile, following the recent massive eruption of an undersea volcano near the Tongan Islands, NASA says the blast could offer clues about the formation of other planets.
We use Earth as our training ground to project what we know from places like this to other planets that might have oceans, that might have volcanoes that erupt underwater. And that could definitely have happened on Mars and Venus. And so they're our sister worlds. We need to understand these processes.
The January 15th eruption was so powerful that space satellites not only captured the clouds of ash, but also an atmospheric shockwave from the volcano close to the speed of sound. NASA's James Garvin says that by studying the life cycle of a volcano like the one in Tonga, scientists have the rare opportunity to understand how other planets formed. And finally this week, the winner of last February's lottery to join the crew of the SpaceX Inspiration 4 mission finally came forward. Florida-based airline pilot Kyle Hipchin won the ticket in a random drawing, but he exceeded the weight limit for the Dragon capsule. Hipchin picked his old college roommate Chris Sombrowski to fly in his place. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Kenya's nomadic herders are among those suffering the most from recurring drought that kills the livestock they depend on. To make them less dependent on rain, aid programs are teaching Kenya's herders how to farm fish and keep bees. Brenda Mulinya has this report from Isiola, Kenya.
39-year-old Makai Mamo feeds the tilapia fish in her pond in Kinna Ward, Isiolo County, Kenya. For the last 2 years, she has been raising fish on her farm, a break from the community's pastoral lifestyle. This change has served her well. As the county deals with the devastating drought that threatens the lives of 2 million people, she has food on her table and surplus for the market. During the drought, she says, we can't buy food in the market. All the goats are too thin. But with fish, we are happy. She says fish only need the pond water. You can catch a big fish that will feed you and your children. The idea was introduced to Isiolo, a county in the northern part of Kenya, in 2019 by the county government in collaboration with the World Food Programme. The initiative is meant to cushion residents from the effects of extreme weather conditions like droughts and floods. Irene Opora is WFP's field officer in Isiolo.
We started off with interventions like the general food distribution, which was a bit reactionary, like after drought or floods, we were giving food to communities. But we then realized over time that it was not sustainable.
The Sustainable Food Systems Program has seen pastoralists try other types of farming aside from livestock. Fish farmers like Makai have tanks that store water pumped from rivers or wells. When it rains, they save the rainwater and store it for the ponds. The county government of Isiolo says diversifying sources of livelihoods has helped lessen the impact of droughts that hit the county and the surrounding areas every few years. Amina Bashi, a fisheries officer in Isiolo County, says the county is determined to get more farmers on board.
Right now, I can say we have a good number of people accepting fish as a livelihood, and they are using it to earn other income, to produce other household needs. Mm-hmm. So right now we have phase two that's coming in. We are targeting 40 fish farmers. We are hoping that with time they'll be able to see fish as other livestock.
The program has grown from 15 groups to more than 50. And individual farmers now farm and consume the fish, as well as practice crop farming, hay production, and beekeeping. The program aims to reach close to 1,000 groups in the next 5 years. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Isiolo, Kenya.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, we're so glad you could join us today. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Have a great weekend, everybody.